Chapter 5. Spiritual Emergency. Understanding and Treatment of Crises of Transformation. Part 2.
The Crisis of Psychic Opening. An increase of intuitive abilities and the occurrence of psychic or paranormal phenomena are very common during spiritual emergencies of all kinds. However, in some instances, the influx of information from non-ordinary sources, such as precognition, telepathy, or clairvoyance, becomes so overwhelming and confusing that it dominates the picture and constitutes a major problem in and of itself. Among the most dramatic manifestations of psychic opening are out-of-body experiences. In the middle of everyday life, and often without any noticeable trigger, one's consciousness seems to detach from the body and witness what is happening in the surroundings or in various remote locations. The information obtained during these episodes by extrasensory perception often corresponds to actual reality and can be verified. Out-of-body experiences occur with extraordinary frequency in near-death situations, where the accuracy of this remote viewing has been established by systematic studies. People experiencing intense psychic openings might be so much in touch with the inner processes of others that they exhibit remarkable telepathic abilities. They might verbalize accurate, incisive insights into other people's minds concerning various issues that these individuals are trying to hide. This can frighten, irritate, and alienate others so severely that it often becomes a significant factor contributing to unnecessary hospitalization or drastic treatment procedures. Similarly, the accurate precognition of future situations and clairvoyant perception, particularly occurring repeatedly in impressive clusters, can seriously disturb the person in crisis, as well as those around them, since it undermines their notion of reality. In experiences that can be called mediumistic, one has a sense of losing one's own identity and taking on the identity of another person. This can involve assuming the other person's body image, posture, gestures, facial expression, feelings, and even thought processes. Accomplished shamans, psychics, and spiritual healers can use such experiences in a controlled and productive way. Unlike the persons in spiritual emergency, they are capable of taking on the identity of others at will and then resuming their own separate identity after they accomplish the task of the session. During the crises of psychic opening, the sudden, unpredictable, and uncontrollable loss of one's ordinary identity can be frightening. People in spiritual crisis often experience uncanny coincidences that link the world of inner realities, such as dreams and visionary states, to happenings in everyday life. This phenomenon was first recognized and described by C.G. Jung, who gave it the name synchronicity and explored it in a special essay. The study of synchronistic events helped Jung realize that archetypes were not principles limited to the intrapsychic domain. It became clear to him that they have what he called a psychoid quality, which means they govern not only the psyche, but also happenings in the world of consensus reality. I've explored this fascinating topic in my other writings and will return to it in a later chapter of this work. Jungian synchronicities represent authentic phenomena and cannot be ignored and discounted as accidental coincidences. They also should not be indiscriminately dismissed as pathological distortions of reality, the perception of meaningful relations where, in actuality, there are none. This is a common practice in contemporary psychiatry, or any allusion to meaningful coincidences is automatically diagnosed as a delusion of reference. In the case of true synchronicities, any open-minded witnesses who have access to all the relevant information recognize that the coincidences involved are beyond any reasonable statistical probability. Extraordinary synchronicities accompany many forms of spiritual emergency, but in crises of psychic opening, they are particularly common. Past life experiences. Among the most dramatic and colorful transpersonal experiences occurring in holotropic states are what appear to be memories from previous incarnations. These are sequences that take place in other historical periods and in other countries, and are usually associated with powerful emotions and physical sensations. They often portray the people, circumstances, and historical settings involved in great detail. Their most remarkable aspect is a convincing sense of remembering and reliving something that one has already seen, déjà vu, or experienced, déjà vécu, at some time in the past. These experiences provide fascinating insights into the belief in karma and reincarnation, which has been independently developed and held by many religious and cultural groups in different parts of the world. The concept of karma and reincarnation represents the cornerstone of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, Zoroastrianism, the Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, and Taoism. Similar ideas occurred in such geographically, historically, and culturally diverse groups as various African tribes, Native Americans, pre-Columbian cultures, the Hawaiian Kahunas, practitioners of the Brazilian Umbanda, the Gauls, and the Druids. In ancient Greece, several major schools of thought subscribed to this concept, including the Pythagoreans, the Orphics, and the Platonists. The Essenes, the Pharisees, the Karaites, and other Jewish and semi-Jewish groups also adopted the concept of karma and reincarnation, and it formed an important part of the Kabbalistic theology of medieval Judaism. Other groups also adhered to this belief, including the Neoplatonists and Gnostics. The rich and accurate information that these past life memories provide, as well as their healing potential, impels us to take them seriously. When the content of a karmic experience fully emerges into consciousness, it can suddenly provide an explanation for many otherwise incomprehensible aspects of one's daily life. Strange difficulties in relationships with certain people, unsubstantiated fears, and peculiar idiosyncrasies and attractions, as well as otherwise baffling emotional and psychosomatic symptoms, suddenly seem to make sense as karmic carryovers from a previous lifetime. These problems typically disappear when the karmic pattern in question is fully and consciously experienced. Past life experiences can complicate life in several different ways. Before their content emerges fully into consciousness and reveals itself, one can be haunted in everyday life by strange emotions, physical sensations, and visions without knowing where they come from or what they mean. Experienced out of context, these experiences naturally appear incomprehensible and irrational. Another kind of complication occurs when a particularly strong karmic experience starts emerging into consciousness in the middle of everyday activities and interferes with normal functioning. One might also feel compelled to act out some of the elements of a karmic pattern before it is fully experienced and understood or completed. For instance, it might suddenly seem that a certain person in one's present life played an important role in a previous incarnation the memory of which is emerging into consciousness. When this happens, one may seek emotional contact with a person who now appears to be a soulmate from one's karmic past, or conversely, seek a confrontation with an adversary from another lifetime. This kind of activity can lead to unpleasant complications, since the alleged karmic partners usually have no basis in their own experiences for understanding this behavior. Even if one manages to avoid the danger of acting out, the problems are not necessarily over. After a past life memory has fully emerged into consciousness, and its content and implications have been revealed to the person, there remains one more challenge. One has to reconcile this experience with the traditional beliefs and values of the Western civilization. The denial of the possibility of reincarnation represents a rare instance of complete agreement between the Christian Church and materialistic science. Therefore, in Western culture, acceptance and intellectual integration of a past life memory is a difficult task for either an atheist or a traditionally raised Christian. Assimilation of past life experiences into one's belief system can be a relatively easy task for someone who does not have a strong commitment to Christianity or to the materialistic worldview. The experiences are usually so convincing that one simply accepts their message and might even feel excited about this new discovery. However, fundamentalist Christians and those who have a strong investment in rationality and the traditional scientific perspective can be catapulted into a period of confusion when they are confronted with convincing personal experiences that seem to challenge their belief system. Communication with spirit guides and channeling. Occasionally, in a holotropic experience, one can encounter a being who assumes the position of a teacher, guide, protector, or simply a relevant source of information. Such beings are usually perceived as discarnate humans, superhuman entities, or deities existing on higher planes of consciousness and endowed with extraordinary wisdom. Occasionally, they introduce themselves as extraterrestrials from distant stars, such as Sirius or the Pleiades. Sometimes they take on the form of a person. At other times, they appear as radiant sources of light, or simply let their presence be sensed. Their messages are usually received in the form of direct thought transfer or through other extrasensory means. In some instances, communication can take the form of verbal messages. A particularly interesting phenomenon in this category is channeling, which has received much attention from the public and mass media in recent decades. A channeling person transmits messages to other people, which were received from a source that appears to be external to his or her consciousness. It occurs through speaking in a trance, using automatic writing, or recording telepathically received thoughts. Channeling has played an important role in the history of humanity. Among the channeled spiritual teachings are many scriptures of enormous cultural influence, such as the ancient Indian Vedas, the Quran, and the Book of Mormon. A remarkable modern example of a channeled text is A Course in Miracles, recorded by psychologist Helen Schuckman and William Thetford. Experiences of channeling can precipitate a serious psychological and spiritual crisis. One possibility is that the individual involved can interpret the experience as an indication of beginning insanity. This is particularly likely if the channeling involves hearing voices, a well-known symptom of paranoid schizophrenia. The quality of the channeled material varies from trivial and questionable chatter to extraordinary information. On occasion, channeling can provide consistently accurate data about subjects to which the recipient was never exposed. This can then appear to be a particularly convincing proof of the involvement of supernatural influences and can lead to serious philosophical confusion for an atheistic person or a scientist with a materialistic worldview. Spirit guides are usually perceived as advanced spiritual beings on a high level of consciousness evolution, who are endowed with superior intelligence and extraordinary moral integrity. This can lead to highly problematic ego inflation in the channeler, who might feel chosen for a special mission and see it as a proof of his or her own superiority. Near-death experiences, NDEs. World mythology, folklore, and spiritual literature abound in vivid accounts of the experiences associated with death and dying. Special sacred texts have been dedicated exclusively to descriptions and discussions of the posthumous journey of the soul, such as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Bardo Todol, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, Pert Emhru, and their European counterpart, Ars Moriendi, the Art of Dying. Pre-Hispanic examples of eschatological texts include the Nahuatl, Aztec, Codex Borgia, describing the death and rebirth of Quetzalcoatl, plumed serpent, and the epic story of the death and rebirth of the hero twins, Hunapu and Espalanque, included in the Mayan Popol Vuh. In the past, the eschatological mythology was discounted by Western scholars as a product of fantasy and the wishful thinking of primitive people who were unable to face the fact of impermanence and their own mortality. This situation changed dramatically after the publication of Raymond Moody's international bestseller, Life After Life, which brought scientific confirmation of these accounts and showed that an encounter with death can be a fantastic adventure in consciousness. Moody's book was based on reports of 150 people who had experienced a close confrontation with death, or were actually pronounced clinically dead, but regained consciousness and lived to tell their stories. Moody reported that people who had had near-death experiences, NDEs, frequently witnessed a review of their entire lives in the form of a colorful, incredibly condensed replay, which occurred over the course of only a few seconds. Consciousness often detached from the body and floated freely above the scene, observing it with curiosity and detached amusement, or traveled to distant locations. Many people described passing through a dark tunnel or funnel toward a divine light of supernatural brilliance and beauty. This light was not physical in nature, but had distinctly personal characteristics. It was a being of light, radiating infinite, all-embracing love, forgiveness, and acceptance. In a personal exchange, often perceived as an audience with God, these individuals received lessons regarding existence and universal laws, and had the opportunity to evaluate their past by these new standards. Then they chose to return to ordinary reality and live their lives in a new way, congruent with the principles they had learned. Since Moody's publication, his findings have been repeatedly confirmed by other researchers. Most survivors emerge from their near-death experiences profoundly changed. They have a universal and all-encompassing spiritual vision of reality, a new system of values, and a radically different general strategy of life. They have a deep appreciation for being alive and feel kinship with all living beings, as well as a concern for the future of humanity and the planet. However, the fact that the encounter with death has a great positive potential does not mean that this transformation is easy. Near-death experiences very frequently lead to spiritual emergencies. A powerful NDE can radically undermine the worldview of the people involved because it catapults them abruptly and without warning into a reality that is diametrically different from their everyday life. A car accident in the middle of rush hour traffic or a heart attack while jogging can launch someone within a few seconds into a fantastic visionary adventure that tears his or her ordinary reality asunder. Following an NDE, people might need special counseling and support to be able to integrate these extraordinary experiences into their everyday life. Close encounters with UFOs and alien abduction experiences. The experience of encountering extraterrestrial spacecrafts and their crews, and of abduction by alien beings, can often precipitate serious emotional and intellectual crises that have much in common with spiritual emergencies. This requires an explanation, since most people consider UFOs in terms of four alternatives: actual visitation by alien spacecraft, hoaxes, the misperception of natural events and devices of terrestrial origin, and psychotic hallucinations. Alvin Lawson made an attempt to explain UFO abduction experiences as misinterpretations of the trauma of birth, using my own concept of basic perinatal matrices. His conclusions were not convincing and fell short of doing justice to this complex and intriguing phenomenon. Descriptions of UFO sightings typically refer to lights that have an uncanny, supernatural quality. These lights resemble those mentioned in many reports of visionary states. C.G. Jung, who dedicated a special study to the problem of flying saucers, or things seen in the skies, suggested that these phenomena might be archetypal visions originating in the collective unconscious of humanity, rather than psychotic hallucinations or actual visits by extraterrestrials. He supported his thesis through careful analysis of stories about flying discs that had been told throughout centuries, and of reports about mysterious apparitions that had occasionally caused crises and mass panic. It has also been pointed out that the extraterrestrial beings involved in these encounters have important parallels in world mythology and religion, systems that have their roots in the collective unconscious. The alien spacecrafts and cosmic flights depicted by those who were allegedly abducted or invited for a ride resemble the descriptions of the chariot of the Vedic god Indra, Ezekiel's flaming machine depicted in the Bible, or the glorious fiery vehicle of the Greek sun god Helios. The fabulous landscapes and cities visited during these journeys resemble the visionary experiences of paradises, celestial realms, and cities of light. The abductees often report that the aliens had taken them into a laboratory and subjected them to physical examinations and strange experiments using various exotic instruments. This often involved probing the cavities of their bodies, with a special emphasis on the genital organs. The abductees also frequently describe what seem to be genetic experiments aimed at creating hybrid offspring. These interventions are usually very painful and occasionally border on torture. This brings the experiences of the abductees close to the initiatory crises of the shamans and to the ordeals of the neophytes in the Aboriginal rites of passage. There is also another reason why a UFO experience can precipitate a spiritual emergency. It is similar to the problem mentioned earlier in relation to spirit guides and channeling. The alien visitors are often seen as representatives of civilizations that are incomparably more advanced than ours, not only technologically, but also intellectually, morally, and spiritually. Such contact often has very powerful mystical undertones and is associated with insights of cosmic relevance. It is thus easy for the recipients of such special attention to interpret it as an indication of their own uniqueness. Abductees might feel that they have attracted the interest of superior beings from an advanced civilization because they themselves are in some way exceptional and particularly suited for a special purpose. In Jungian psychology, a situation in which the individual claims the luster of the archetypal world for his or her own person is referred to as ego inflation. For these reasons, experiences of close encounters can lead to serious transpersonal crises. People who have experienced the strange world of UFO encounters and alien abduction need professional help from someone who has a general knowledge of archetypal psychology and who is also familiar with the specific characteristics of the UFO phenomenon. Experienced researchers, such as Harvard psychiatrist John Mack, have brought ample evidence that the alien abduction experiences represent a serious conceptual challenge for Western psychiatry and materialistic science in general, and that it is naive and indefensible to see them as manifestations of mental disease or discard them altogether. He concluded that these experiences qualify as anomalous phenomena, observations that seriously challenge our current scientific worldview. His experiences with this research inspired him to start the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, PEER, in 1993. Over the years, I have worked with many individuals who had experiences of alien abduction in psychedelic sessions, holotropic breathwork, and in spiritual emergencies. Almost without exception, these episodes were extremely intense and experientially convincing. On occasion, they also had definite psychoid features. In view of my observations, I am convinced that these experiences represent phenomena sui generis and deserve to be seriously studied. The position of mainstream psychiatrists who see them as products of an unknown pathological process in the brain is clearly oversimplistic and highly implausible. The alternative, considering the UFOs to be actual visits of aliens from other celestial bodies, is equally implausible. An extraterrestrial civilization capable of sending spaceships to our planet would have to have technical means that we can hardly imagine. We have enough information about the planets of the solar system to know that they are unlikely sources of such an expedition. The distance between the solar system and the nearest stars amounts to several light years. Negotiating such distances would require velocities approaching the speed of light or interdimensional travel through hyperspace. A civilization capable of such achievements would very likely have technology that would make it impossible for us to differentiate between hallucinations and reality. Until more reliable information is available, it seems most plausible to see the UFO experiences as manifestations of archetypal material from the collective unconscious. Possession states. People in this type of transpersonal crisis have a distinct feeling that their psyche and body have been invaded, and that they are being controlled by an evil entity or energy with personal characteristics. They perceive it as coming from outside their own personality and as being hostile and disturbing. It might appear to be a confused, discarnate entity, a demonic archetypal being, or the consciousness of a wicked person invading them by means of black magic and hexing procedures. There are many different types and degrees of such conditions. In some instances, the true nature of this disorder remains hidden. The problem manifests as serious psychopathology, such as antisocial or even criminal behavior, suicidal depression, murderous aggression, or self-destructive behavior. Promiscuous and deviant sexual impulses and acting out, or excessive use of alcohol and drugs. It is often not until such a person starts experiential psychotherapy that possession is identified as a condition underlying these problems. In the middle of an experiential session, the face of a possessed person can become cramped and take the form of a mask of evil, and the eyes can assume a wild expression. The hands and body might develop strange contortions, and the voice may become altered and take on an otherworldly quality. When the situation is allowed to develop, the session can bear a striking resemblance to exorcisms in the Catholic Church or exorcist rituals in various Aboriginal cultures. The resolution often comes after dramatic episodes of choking, projectile vomiting, and frantic physical activity, or even temporary loss of control. If sequences of this kind are properly treated, they can be unusually healing and transformative, and often result in a deep spiritual conversion of the person involved. A detailed description of the most dramatic episode of this kind that I have observed during my entire professional career can be found in my book, When the Impossible Happens. Interview with the Devil, The Case of Flora. Other times, the possessed person is aware of the presence of the evil entity and spends a lot of effort trying to fight it and control its influence. In the extreme version of the possession state, the problematic energy can spontaneously manifest and take over the person in the middle of everyday life. This situation resembles the one described earlier for experiential sessions, but the individual here lacks the support and protection provided by the therapeutic context. Under such circumstances, he or she can feel extremely frightened and desperately alone. Relatives, friends, and often even therapists tend to withdraw from the possessed individual and respond with a strange mixture of metaphysical fear and moral rejection. They often label the person as evil and refuse further contact. This condition clearly belongs in the category of spiritual emergency, in spite of the fact that it involves negative energies and is associated with many objectionable forms of behavior. The demonic archetype is by its very nature transpersonal, since it represents the negative mirror image of the divine. It also often appears to be a gateway phenomenon, comparable to the terrifying guardians flanking the doors of Eastern temples. It hides access to a profound spiritual experience, which often follows after a possession state has been successfully resolved. With the help of somebody who is not afraid of its uncanny nature and is able to encourage its full conscious manifestation, this energy can be dissipated and remarkable healing occurs. Alcoholism and drug addiction as spiritual emergency. It makes sense to describe addiction as a form of spiritual emergency, in spite of the fact that it differs in its external manifestations from more obvious types of psycho-spiritual crises. As with possession states, the spiritual dimension is obscured by the destructive and self-destructive nature of the disorder. While in other forms of spiritual emergency, people encounter problems because of their difficulty in coping with mystical experiences, In addiction, the source of the problem is a strong spiritual longing, and the fact that the contact with the mystical dimension has not been made. There exists ample evidence that behind the craving for drugs or alcohol is the unrecognized craving for transcendence or wholeness. Many recovering people talk about their restless search for some unknown missing element or dimension in their lives, and describe their unfulfilling and frustrating pursuit of substances, food, relationships, possessions, or power, which reflects an unrelenting effort to satiate this craving. We already discussed a certain superficial similarity that exists between mystical states and intoxication by alcohol or hard drugs. Both of these conditions share the sense of dissolution of individual boundaries, the disappearance of disturbing emotions, and the transcendence of mundane problems. Although the intoxication with alcohol or drugs lacks many important characteristics of the mystical state, such as serenity, numinosity, and richness of philosophical insights, the experiential overlap is sufficient to seduce alcoholics and addicts into abuse. William James wrote about this connection in Varieties of Religious Experience. The sway of alcohol over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature. Usually crushed to earth by the cold facts and dry criticisms of the sober hour, sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. He also saw the important implications of genuine transcendental experiences for successful therapy. C.G. Jung's independent insight in this regard was instrumental in the development of the worldwide network of 12-step programs. It is not generally known that Jung played a very important role in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. The information about this little-known aspect of Jung's work can be found in a letter that Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, wrote to Jung in 1961. Jung had a patient, Roland H., who came to him after having exhausted other means of recovery from alcoholism. Following a temporary improvement after a year's treatment with Jung, he suffered a relapse. Jung told him that his case was hopeless and suggested that his only chance was to join a religious community and hope for a profound spiritual experience. Roland H. joined the Oxford Group, an evangelical movement emphasizing self-survey, confession, and service. There he experienced a religious conversion that freed him from alcoholism. He then returned to New York City and became very active in the Oxford Group there. He was able to help Bill Wilson's friend, Edwin T., who in turn helped Bill Wilson in his personal crisis. In his powerful spiritual experience, Bill Wilson had a vision of a worldwide fellowship chain of alcoholics helping each other. Years later, Wilson wrote Jung a letter, in which he brought the important role that Jung played in the history of AA to his attention. Jung understood the basic strategy for treating alcoholism and expressed it in his response to Wilson as spiritus contra spiritum. Deep spiritual experiences are the antidote to alcoholism. James's and Jung's insights have since been confirmed by clinical research programs using psychedelic therapy with alcoholics and narcotic drug addicts. Treatment of spiritual emergencies. The psychotherapeutic strategy for individuals undergoing spiritual crises reflects the principles that we have discussed earlier in this book. It is based on the realization that these states are not manifestations of an unknown pathological process, but results of a spontaneous movement in the psyche that has healing and transformative potential. The understanding and appropriate treatment of spiritual emergencies requires a vastly extended model of the psyche that includes the perinatal and transpersonal dimensions. The nature and degree of the therapeutic assistance that is necessary depends on the intensity of the psychospiritual process involved. In mild forms of spiritual emergency, the person in crisis is usually able to cope with the holotropic experiences in the course of everyday life. All that he or she needs is the opportunity to discuss the process with a transpersonally oriented therapist who provides constructive feedback and helps the client to integrate the experiences into everyday life. If the process is more active, it might require regular sessions of experiential therapy to facilitate the emergence of the unconscious material and the full expression of emotions and blocked physical energies. The general strategy of this approach is identical with that used in holotropic breathwork sessions. When the experiences are very intense, we just have to encourage the client to surrender to the process. If we encounter strong psychological resistance, we might occasionally use faster breathing and releasing bodywork, like in the termination periods of breathwork sessions. Holotropic breathwork, as such, is indicated only if the natural unfolding of the process reaches an impasse. These intense experiential sessions can be complemented with Gestalt practice, Dora Kalf's Jungian sand play, or bodywork with a psychologically experienced practitioner. A variety of auxiliary techniques can also prove extremely useful under these circumstances. Among them are writing in a journal, painting mandalas, expressive dancing, and jogging, swimming, or other sport activities. If the client is able to concentrate on reading transpersonally oriented books, particularly those specifically focusing on the problem of psycho-spiritual crises or some specific aspect of his or her inner experience, it can be extremely helpful. People whose experiences are so intense and dramatic that they cannot be handled on an outpatient basis represent a special problem. There are practically no facilities that offer 24-hour supervision without the use of routine suppressive psychopharmacological intervention. Creating such alternative centers is a necessary prerequisite for the effective therapy of spiritual emergencies in the future. Several of these kinds of experimental facilities used to exist in California, such as John Perry's Diabasis in San Francisco and Chrysalis in San Diego, or Barbara Findison's Pocket Ranch in Geyserville, California, but they were short-lived. Although the cost of these programs was about one-third of traditional psychiatric treatment, these experimental facilities were not financially sustainable. Since the insurance companies refused to pay for alternative forms of therapy, the costs had to be covered by the patients or their relatives. This occasional support was not sufficient or reliable enough to offset the situation. In some places, helpers have tried to overcome this deficiency by creating teams of trained facilitators who took shifts in the client's home for the duration of the episode. Managing intense acute forms of spiritual emergency requires some extraordinary measures, though, whether it occurs in a special facility or in a private home. Extended episodes of this kind can last for days or weeks and can be associated with a lot of physical activity, intense emotions, loss of appetite, and insomnia. This brings a danger of dehydration, vitamin and mineral deficiency, and exhaustion. An insufficient food supply can lead to hypoglycemia, which is known to weaken psychological defenses and bring additional material from the unconscious. This can lead to a vicious cycle that perpetuates the acute condition. Tea with honey, bananas, or other foods that contain glucose can be of great help in breaking this cycle and grounding the process. A person in intense psycho-spiritual crisis is usually so deeply involved in his or her experience that they forget about food, drink, and basic hygiene. It is thus up to the helpers to take care of the client's basic needs. Since the care for people undergoing the most acute forms of spiritual emergency is unusually demanding, the helpers have to take shifts to protect their own mental and physical health. To guarantee comprehensive and integrated care under these circumstances, it is necessary to keep a log and carefully record the intake of food, liquids, and vitamins. Sleep deprivation, like fasting, tends to weaken the defenses and facilitate the influx of unconscious material into consciousness. This can also lead to a vicious cycle that needs to be interrupted. It might therefore be necessary to occasionally give the client a minor tranquilizer or a hypnotic to secure sleep. In this context, medication is seen as a purely palliative measure and is not considered therapy, which is the way tranquilizing medication is often presented in mainstream psychiatry. The administration of minor tranquilizers or hypnotics interrupts the vicious cycle and gives the client the rest and energy necessary to continue with the uncovering process the following day. In later stages of spiritual emergency, when the intensity of the process subsides, the person no longer requires constant supervision. He or she resumes the responsibility of their own basic personal care and gradually returns to everyday activities and duties. The overall duration of the stay in a protective environment depends on the rate of stabilization and integration of the process. If necessary, we might schedule occasional experiential sessions and recommend the use of selected complementary and auxiliary approaches. Regular discussions about the experiences and insights from the time of the episode can be of great help in integrating it. The treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction presents some specific problems and has to be discussed separately from that of other spiritual emergencies. More specifically, it is the element of physiological addiction and the progressive nature of the disorder that requires special measures. Before dealing with the psychological problems underlying addiction, it is imperative to break the chemical cycle that perpetuates the use of substances. The individual has to go through a period of withdrawal and detoxification in a special residential facility. Once this is accomplished, the focus can turn to the psycho-spiritual roots of the disorder. As we have seen, alcoholism and drug addiction represent a misguided search for transcendence. For this reason, to be successful, the therapeutic program has to include a strong emphasis on the spiritual dimension of the problem as an integral part. Historically, the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, and Narcotics Anonymous, NA, fellowships offering a comprehensive approach based on the 12-step philosophy outlined by Bill Wilson, have been the most successful in combating addiction. Following the program step by step, the alcoholic or addict recognizes and admits that they have lost control over their lives and have become powerless. They are encouraged to surrender and let a higher power of their own definition take over. A painful review of their personal history produces an inventory of their wrongdoings. This provides the basis for making amends to all the people whom they have hurt with their addiction. The 12-step programs are invaluable in providing support and guidance for alcoholics and addicts from the beginning of treatment and throughout the years of sobriety and recovery. Since the focus of this book is the healing potential of holotropic states, we will now explore whether and in what way these states can be useful in the treatment of addiction. This question is closely related to the 11th step, which emphasizes the need to improve through prayer and meditation our conscious contact with God as we understand God. Since holotropic states can facilitate mystical experiences, they clearly fit in this category. Over the years, I have had extensive experience with the use of holotropic states and the treatment of alcoholics and addicts, as well as in the work with recovering people who use them to improve the quality of their sobriety. I participated in a team at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore that conducted large controlled studies of psychedelic therapy with alcoholics and hard drug addicts. I have also had the opportunity to witness the effect of serial holotropic breathwork sessions on many recovering people in the context of our training. In my experience, it is highly unlikely that either holotropic breathwork or psychedelic therapy can help alcoholics and addicts when they are actively using. Even deep and meaningful experiences do not seem to have the power to break the chemical cycle involved. Therapeutic work with holotropic states should be introduced only after alcoholics and addicts have undergone detoxification, overcome the withdrawal symptoms, and reached sobriety. Only then can they benefit from holotropic experiences and do some deep work on the psychological problems underlying their addiction. At this point, holotropic states can be extremely useful in helping them to confront traumatic memories, process the difficult emotions associated with them, and obtain valuable insights into the psychological roots of their abuse. Holotropic experiences can mediate the process of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth that is known as hitting bottom, and is a critical turning point in the life of many alcoholics and addicts. The experience of ego death happens in a protected situation where it does not have the dangerous physical, interpersonal, and social consequences that it would have if it happened spontaneously in the client's natural surroundings, especially with the risk of confusion between ego side and suicide. Holotropic states can also mediate experiential access to profound spiritual experiences, the true object of the alcoholic's or addict's craving, and thus make it less likely that they will seek unfortunate surrogates in alcohol or narcotics. The programs of psychedelic therapy for alcoholics and addicts conducted at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center were very successful, in spite of the fact that the protocol limited the number of psychedelic sessions to a maximum of 3. At a 6-month follow-up, more than 50% of chronic alcoholics and 1/3 of narcotic drug addicts participating in these programs were still sober and were considered essentially rehabilitated by an independent evaluation team. Recovering people in our training and workshops, almost without exception, see holotropic breathwork as a way of improving the quality of their sobriety and facilitating their psycho-spiritual growth. In spite of the evidence of their beneficial effects, the use of holotropic states in recovering people found strong opposition among some conservative members of the 12-step movement. These people assert that alcoholics and addicts seeking any form of a high are experiencing a relapse. They pass this judgment not only when the holotropic state involves the use of psychedelic substances, but also extend it to experiential forms of psychotherapy and even to meditation, an approach explicitly recommended in the original description of the 11th step. It is likely that this extremist attitude goes back to Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, and his experiences with LSD. After 20 years of sobriety, Bill Wilson became interested in LSD and had a series of sessions with Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd under the supervision of Los Angeles psychedelic pioneers Sidney Cohen and Betty Eisner. Bill Wilson became very enthusiastic about the effects of this substance. he felt that the sessions helped him significantly with his chronic depression and opened him up to a spiritual perception of the world. As he approached his 70th birthday, he developed a plan to have LSD distributed at all AA meetings nationwide. Bill Wilson's use of LSD and his proposal caused considerable controversy within AA. Many of his close associates, including Dr. Jack Norris, then chairman of the AA Board of Trustees, were very concerned about his use of psychedelics and his controversial idea for the future of AA. The plan was eventually quashed by more rational voices, and Bill Wilson was asked to discontinue his experiments with LSD. In 1958, he defended his drug use in a long letter, but soon afterwards, he removed himself from the AA governing body to be free to do his experiments. We are confronted with two conflicting perspectives on the relationship between holotropic states of consciousness and addiction. One of them sees any effort to depart from the ordinary state of consciousness to be unacceptable for an addicted person and qualifies as a relapse. This attitude demands sobriety at any cost, even if it means white-knuckling it. The AA members who represent this attitude do not seem to see any problem in the enormous amount of coffee that is typically served and consumed in the AA meetings, and the number of cigarettes that are usually smoked there. The opposing view is based on the idea that seeking a spiritual state is a legitimate and natural tendency of human nature, and that striving for transcendence is the most powerful motivating force in the psyche. Addiction is then seen as a misguided and distorted form of this effort, and the most effective remedy for it is facilitating access to a genuine spiritual experience. The future will decide which of these two approaches will be adopted by professionals and by the recovering community. In my opinion, the most promising development in the treatment of alcoholism and drug abuse would be a marriage of the 12-step programs, the most effective method for treating alcoholism and addiction, with transpersonal psychology, which can provide a solid theoretical basis for spiritually grounded therapy. Responsible work with holotropic states of consciousness would be a very logical and integral part of such a comprehensive approach. In the 1990s, my wife Christina and I organized two conferences of the International Transpersonal Association, ITA, in Eugene, Oregon, and in Atlanta, Georgia, called Mystical Quest, Attachment, and Addiction. These meetings demonstrated the feasibility and usefulness of bringing together the 12-step programs and transpersonal psychology. The empirical and theoretical justification for such merging was discussed in several publications. The concept of spiritual emergency is new, though, and will undoubtedly be complemented and refined in the future. However, we have repeatedly seen that even in its present form, as defined by Christina and myself, it has been of great help to many individuals in crises of transformation. We have observed that when these conditions are treated with respect and receive appropriate support, they can result in remarkable healing, deep positive transformation, and a higher level of functioning in everyday life. This has often happened in spite of the fact that, in the present situation, the conditions for treating people in psycho-spiritual crises are far from ideal. In the future, the success of this endeavor could increase considerably if people capable of assisting individuals in spiritual emergencies could have a network of 24-hour centers for those whose experiences are so intense that they cannot be treated on an outpatient basis. At present, the absence of such facilities and lack of support from the insurance companies for unconventional approaches represent the most serious obstacles in the effective application of the new therapeutic strategies.